Demodulate, Episode 2. When I was a teenager in the late 1980s, if you had walked into my bedroom, it might have sounded a lot like this. My computer dialing phone number after phone number, looking for modem carriers. On this episode of Demodulate, we'll be discussing war dialing.
Hello.
We'll discuss why hackers did it and the techniques that they used. In the 1980s and early 90s, most people who owned a computer did not have access to any sort of network, or especially computer network. They're mostly islands unto themselves. So if you owned a computer, it pretty much just sat on your desk, not connected to anything other than the power and the monitor and the keyboard that you're using. So you might use it to write code or play video games or something like that. But for the most part, for most people, it wasn't a communications tool. It was just a tool to get things done, spreadsheets, documents, stuff like that. And keep in mind, around this time, there was no public internet like we know it today. At some point back then, you would run into somebody who had a device called a modem. And modem stands for modulate, demodulate, hence the name of this podcast. Anyways, what a modem allowed a person to do was use their computer, along with a phone line and a modem, to connect to other computer systems, in particular bulletin board systems, also known as BBSs. Bulletin board systems allow people to communicate. It was an early form of, for instance, you know, email. So I could send it a one-to-one message between certain people that I knew. But then there was also public bulletin boards. We look at them as forums now on the internet, where you could post questions and get answers to those questions. And those forums range from everything from writing software to the latest public domain software, which was kind of cool at the time. So, for instance, you might not only talk on these bulletin boards or even chat on these bulletin board systems, but you could download software, like this public domain software. It's completely legal, and you could just download it and play with it, and it was a lot of fun. But there was some subgenres of bulletin board systems that were considered kind of underground bulletin board systems. So I remember having my friends tell me about pirate bulletin board systems. So basically you could call into them and they would not only talk about how to crack or defeat copy protections on pieces of software, but would allow you to download pirated software itself. That is software that you were supposed to be paying for, but you could download for free because somebody had beat the protection on it. And when you're a teenage kid sitting on your little isolated island, this is very, very intriguing stuff. This is like super, super interesting. But I also had friends who not only did the pirated bulletin board, you know, dialed into those a lot, but they would dial into hacker and freak bulletin boards. And that was even more interesting to a person like me at the time, because this was the stuff that movies were made of. I mean, quite literally, like movies like War Games and stuff at the time. And these bulletin boards, like, they took it to a next level in that they were looking at how to make free phone calls around the world. Nowadays, making a connection to a computer in anywhere in the world is not a big deal. But at this point in time, it was a very, very, very big deal. But they also talked about how to break into other computer systems. Like, so for instance, if you ran into a prompt that worked a certain way or a login that looked a certain way, how to exploit those systems. And that was super, super intriguing to a teenager. So now, after hearing all the stories about bulletin board systems and pirate boards and hacking bulletin boards, you have to have a modem. I mean, in my case, I was stuck on this island. I wanted off the island. I wanted to be able to connect to other machines and read those posts on bulletin boards, especially the hacker and pirate bulletin boards, and download free games. Are you kidding me? So you have to get a modem. But the problem is modems aren't cheap at this time. They're actually very, very expensive. So you either have to save up all summer mowing lawns or whatever you need to do it, or beg for one for Christmas. In my particular case, I remember I went to my mom, and she said, "What do you want for Christmas?" I said, "I want a 1660 modem, 1660 Commodore 64 modem." And she said, "No way, never going to happen. You're just going to get in trouble." So I did the logical thing. I went to my dad, who had actually worked at Burroughs Corporation, a large computer company. I said, hey, Dad, I want a modem. And he said, yeah, sure. That sounds like a great idea. And I got a modem, much to my mom's dismay. Okay, so you have your modem, but now you need some place to dial into, right? Well, obviously, the place that you go to first are your buddies who were bragging about, you know, the bulletin boards that they were dialing into. So you ask them for phone numbers. And then typically, once you connect up to a bulletin board, you could download like a list of other bulletin boards to connect to. For things like the Hack Freak bulletin boards, your buddy might need to vouch for you because he wouldn't just let anybody onto that board because obviously they're doing illegal activity. So they don't want to just let everybody on. So maybe they vouch for you. So you connect it to bulletin boards, you download software, you read a whole bunch of text files that you're downloading from these various different bulletin boards on how to break into different types of computer systems and whatnot. But, you know, you have to find these other computer systems to break into. So you kind of have this realization that bulletin boards are the hobbyist answer to communications within their community. So that is, you know, BBS operators set these things up, or sysops set these things up as a means so that their users, people who dial in, can talk to one another. But companies and universities don't use modems that way. They use modems as a means of what we call today like telework, so that they can fix problems without having to drive in. As a hacker, I mean, those are the phone numbers that you really, really want to find, is for those, you know, corporations and universities and things like that. BBS numbers are easy to find. Those are very public. I mean, BBSs want to be successful, so they publish their phone numbers everywhere. Even underground bulletin board systems would do this to a degree. They might not let you on, but they would want you to know what phone number to call. Obviously, companies, organizations like that wouldn't want you to know their phone numbers to their VAX or to a terminal server or to a Unix box. So you had to find them some way. One way to find those phone numbers was through war dialing. And when I say war dialing, that means like calling thousands and thousands of phone numbers and classifying them. In my particular case, all I cared about were modem carriers, because that gave me a target to attack, like a computer system to look at. Other people did things like hand scanning. So for instance, like rather than using a computer to actually dial the phone numbers and classify them, they would do them manually, calling them and writing down in a journal or whatnot what they found. Other people were interested in, you know, certain types of phone switching equipment and things like that. So they might set up their war dials to look for that. In my particular case, it was looking for modems. And a lot of people's cases, I think back then, it was looking mostly for modems. But that was one method that you would use to find potential targets. So on the face of it, this doesn't seem that hard. You just dial a bunch of phone numbers and look for modem carriers, right? But the problem is that phone companies don't want you doing this. So they actually come up with techniques to detect if you're doing mass dialing, especially I'm talking about like the 1980s and 1990s, but they would detect if you were making all these phone calls and flag your line, disable it. They could do all kinds of things to you. So if you were writing war dialing software, you had to take these things into account. So you would come up with like tactics about how to evade the phone system's measures to detect you. So you'd come up with countermeasures to evade them. And it was kind of like this cat and mouse game. Coding war dialers was one of my earliest memories of basically writing code. It was just so much fun sitting with my Commodore 64 and my 1660 modem and dialing thousands and thousands of phone numbers and coming up with these different techniques so that my phone line didn't get shut down all the time. And, you know, that was 40 years ago. And even to this day, you know, I'll occasionally do some war dialing and whatnot. But what's interesting is now the world's even more open. So you have things like voice over IP. And that's what the show's going to be about today. We're going to talk to some very interesting people like H.D. Moore and Jay Falcon and Lucky 225 about war dialing. So let's do it. So before we get too far into this, let's cover some basic phrases in war dialing terminology. Number one, what made a phone number interesting? Well, that was largely dependent on who was doing the war dialing or hand scanning. As I kind of alluded to earlier, in my particular case, I was interested in computers hooked to modems that were hooked to the phone network. I like that because I could use my modem to connect up to them and then explore the systems that I found. But people war dialed and hand scanned for many different reasons. Sometimes it was to find telco equipment. That's telephone equipment primarily used by employees of the telephone company. So, for instance, things like the automatic number announcement service, the ANACs or loops or stuff like that. Other people were interested in PBXs. So they would look for companies, kind of, you can think of a PBX, a private branch exchange, as a miniature telephone network, but was owned by the company. It was internal to them. So some people like to find PBXs and explore how companies built their little internal networks, their phone networks. Voicemail systems could be interesting. So, for instance, finding people who had voicemail boxes that were set up with default codes or test boxes and stuff like that. Fax machines, even elevators were connected to the phone network. So, again, it largely depended on who was doing the dialing. Number two, modems. These were the devices that hooked up to your computer, which in turn hooked up to the phone network and allowed you to connect to other computers, which were connected to the phone network. Typically came in two varieties, the internal modem, which was a small card that you put inside your computer, which hooked up to a phone line. The disadvantages to that is that you couldn't really hear them. The speakers were inside the computer. They're kind of muffled and tucked away. Most of the people that I knew who liked to do lots of war dialing had sets of external modems. These modems sat outside of your computer. They're little boxes, that standalone boxes that hooked up through a serial port and connected up to the modem. The advantages to external were that they had speakers so you could hear what was going on and lots of flashy blinky lights, which looked cool. Number three, the Hayes command set. So the Hayes command set allowed you, the user of the modem or software on your computer, to communicate with the modem. That is, tell the modem what to do. So for instance, dial a phone number or hang up. The Hayes command set was a pretty simple set of instructions. So you would connect to the modem using a piece of software, your war dialer, or it might be through a terminal. And when you connected up to it, you could send a series of commands. And these commands typically started with AT. AT meant attention. So if you typed in ATDT 1-904-555-1212, that meant attention, dial tone, and then the phone number. And then the phone would dial. ATH, on the other hand, would be attention, hang up. Things like plus, plus, plus would get the modem's attention. So to switch you between being connected to the remote computer and then connecting back up to the modem to tell it to do something, to send the modem commands. So the AT command set, which was developed by a company called Hayes Corporation, was a means of communicating with the modem. The Hayes command set also gave you a thing called S registers. So S registers allowed you to configure the modem. So for instance, how fast the modem could dial, should it automatically answer the phone when somebody calls in, things like that. So it also give you a means of configuring the modem to exactly the specifications that you needed. Number four, and you're going to hear this one from time to time, NPA, that stands for number plan area code. You'll hear most people just call it area code, but in the hacker/freak community, you'll hear it referred to as NPA. When you hear NPA, think area code. Number five, NXX. This is the Central Office Exchange code, and it comes after the NPAs. It's also referred to as a prefix. For example, let's say you have a phone number 904-555-1212. 904 would be the NPA. The NXX or prefix would be 555. Now, one thing I would like to point out is that these terms that I'm using, NPA, NXX, and the way phone numbers are structured, are pretty much a North American type of thing. So, for instance, in Europe, Russia, and stuff like that, these terms obviously won't necessarily apply. Number six, the subscriber number. This is after the NPA and after the NXX. So if you have a number like 904-555-1212, the 1212 is the subscriber number. Number 7, call supervision. And this is kind of an important one. What this basically means is that when you call somebody and the target picks up the phone, that is, a human picks up the phone or a piece of equipment picks up the phone physically on their phone line, the call is what they call supervised. If you call a phone number and you get a busy signal or it rings, it's not supervised. And this could be really important in things like, so for instance, if you're war dialing through voice over IP, when a call doesn't supervise, you don't get billed for it. That is a busy signal, ringing, stuff like that. You only get billed when somebody picks up the phone. So if you're doing war dialing, especially on things like voice over IP, the faster that you can figure out if something on the remote side is a voice or something like that, something that maybe you're not interested in, the quicker that you can hang up and the less that it costs. Any phone numbers that you call that are busy or ring out, meaning that they just ring, 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 nobody ever picks up, you don't pay for it all. So call supervision. Keep that in mind. Number 8, reverse directories. To be honest, nobody in the show really brought up reverse directories, but I thought it would be worth it to mention. So way back in the day, as many of you probably realize, there used to be this thing called telephone books, telephone directories. And what it allowed you to do was look for a person's first and last name and find their phone number if they were listed. There was also another phone book which actually did the opposite. So what it allowed you to do was look up a phone number and find out who owned that phone number. The thing was is that the telephone companies didn't print too many of these. They're fairly expensive to have or to get your hands on. But what a lot of people didn't know back then is that the public library usually had a copy of these. But because they were so expensive and kind of like these weird niche items, when you go to the public library and you'd say, I would like a reverse telephone directory, they would typically ask you for like an ID. They would hold on to your ID. So if you ran off with it, they would know where to come and find you. Reverse directories were really useful in things like hand scanning and war dialing, because you would find a lot of phone numbers where you would have no idea what the phone number, like who owned the phone number, like what computer system you were connecting to. So what reverse directories allowed you to do was to find businesses and owners of phone numbers that were within a certain range. The idea here was that if you found a phone number and you saw a business and it looked like it had a block of phone numbers around that particular area, you could make an assumption that that business probably owned that modem and that phone line. Wasn't always the case. But a lot of times when companies would buy phone numbers, they'd typically buy them in blocks. And when they bought them in blocks, the blocks would typically be around a certain range. So this was a method used to determine who owned a certain phone number that you had found. Imagine you dial into something and all it says is login. Well, it doesn't really tell you who owns the phone number. So sometimes reverse directories would help you get a guesstimation about who might own this computer system. Anyways, I just thought I should throw that in there. Number 9, the PSTN, the Public Switched Telephone Network. When you hear this, just think of the telephone network. Number 10, ANI, or ANI, which stands for Automatic Number Identification. ANI is used on the PSTN to identify who called what. Most common, it's a way for emergency services to determine who is calling them. But it's also used in things like long-distance billing and stuff like that. ANI should not be confused with things like caller ID. Caller ID is a consumer-grade service. It allows you to see who's calling you, but to be honest, it's easily spoofed and really should never be trusted. ANI is kind of a back-end thing on the PSTN, which allows them to record who is calling where. So when you hear things like any failures and stuff like that during the show, they're basically saying is they're able to make a phone call and the target is unable to identify who is actually calling them. So just keep that in mind. If you were war dialing in the 1980s or 1990s, it is more than likely that you were a teenager when you were doing it. With that in mind, some of the earliest targets that hackers had when they were war dialing at that time was their high school. It probably had a lot to do with the fact that, you know, breaking into a computer system and changing your grades was like an easy win, you know. It also was gave you bragging rights if you could pull it off. There were movies made about this, War Games. Matthew Broderick, you know, breaks into his high school computer system, changes the grades there. He also did another movies as well. Point being is it always becomes like the first target of every war dialer that I've ever met, myself included, by the way. So I was talking to my buddy, Lucky225. He is a fairly well-known foam freak, hacker, all-around awesome dude. I've known him for years. And of course, we started talking, and this comes up.
I war dialed my... I noticed that my school district had a prefix that only they seemed to use. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't a prefix that many people had as like their landlines or anything, but so it seemed like it was set aside like specifically for my school, or at least 1,000 block of it was.
Right.
And so yeah, I war dialed that whole prefix and came up with an HP Unix system that the school district used for record keeping and grades and everything.
So you were able to compromise it then?
Yes. I actually I got to log into that system right before the year 2000, in 1999, and it just happened to be a combination of social engineering and luck. Our high school newspaper had some article in it about how the district was switching over from some old software to this Microsoft Access database software in order to fix a Y2K bug that was in their current system. And so I basically used that piece of information to gain confidence by calling the high school, and I asked for my vice principal, told her I was from the district IT department, and I was like, you know, you may have heard that we're switching everything over to Microsoft Access. I'm like, right now we're in the middle of taking the database of all the users and transferring it to the new one. I'm like, so are you currently logged into your machine right now? And she said, yeah. I said, good. If you could go ahead and just not log out, because I'm doing a database update, I'm going to need your username and your password, and I'm going to enter it into the system, and then I'm going to have you log out and log back in to make sure that your password's still working after I update the database. And she says, oh, okay. And she just gives me her credentials. And I said, okay, now can you log out and log back in and let me know that your password is still working? And she says, yeah, it's working. I said, oh, great. I said, listen, if you could go ahead and just let everyone in the office know that we're going to be calling. And, you know, we're going to be updating their password in the new database. That would be great.
So when Lucky225 was telling the story, one thing you'll probably pick out is that he knew the phone numbers that he would expect to find his school's computer systems in, because he knew what block that they would be in. He knew what prefix they would be in, or at least 1,000 block of a specific prefix is what he's saying. This is important. Like when you're war dialing, because it allows you to like target things. So understanding what your how your local calling area is arranged was super important. So for instance, I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. So in Tallahassee, I knew what was state and local government. I knew what was university, and I knew what was residential and what parts of town those phone numbers were. So for instance, the NPA is 850 in Tallahassee. So if it was 850-488 or 850-487, I immediately know that's going to be state and local government. If it was 850-644, That was local university, Florida State University. If that was 850-385 or 386, that was residential on a certain part of town. Now, if you're going to do war dialing, having that information about how the numbers are geographically located and who they're primarily used for is super important and would dictate how you're going to do a war dial. So, for example, people in state and local government, if you wanted to war dial state and local government, you wouldn't dial during the daytime because you're just going to irritate tons and tons of people and they may flag or call the phone company and complain. So knowing that they don't work at 2 a.m. in the morning, that's when you do your war dial. However, if it was you, your target was in a residential area, say 850-385, you would do that during the day with the idea that most of those people are going to be at work, so they won't be at home, so you won't irritate people. So again, when I was talking about strategies about war dialing, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Lucky understands where he needs to war dial because he knows his dialing area. It was kind of a cool thing.
You know, Sand, he found a 800 number that was went to a Shiva Land Rover where it was just username root, no password. And, you know, it had internet dial up and it was 800 number. So like, he was like, hey, like, you know, if you ever need internet, like this 800 number, just, you know,
gives it to you.
Yeah. He's like, just put in dial up networking. He's like, just username root, no password. And you'll get right on the internet. Right.
Right.
And I was like, all right, cool. And,
This is already such a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, at the time, like I knew that I could automatically like send an anti-fail by going through AT&T's 1010-2880.
Okay. So you already had that in mind. Okay. That's not saying this is already such a bad idea, but you already thought of this. Okay.
So yeah, I had my modem set to just like dial 1010-2880, comma, to wait. And then when AT&T answered, it would just, you know, punch in the 800 number and connect. And then so like, I get on IRC through this Shiva Land Rover that Sand gives me, right?
Right.
And the DNS on it comes back to fhwa.dot.ca.gov.
Oh, great.
And I'm just like, all right, yeah, this is cool. I'm just, I've seen from the Federal Highway, California Department of Transportation.
So I wanted to recap this conversation that I was having with Lucky 225 for the layperson. What he's saying is he has a friend named Sand. Sand is a hacker in the community. He's old school. He's actually a mutual friend of ours. He's an awesome guy. Sand calls up Lucky 225 and he says, hey, I found this phone number. And if you call it, it's a 1-800 phone number, toll free, meaning it costs you nothing. And if you call it and you enter the username root without a password, it will get you on the internet, probably through something like a PPP connection. Now, I know this doesn't sound like that big of a deal today, but back then, this was actually a pretty big deal. It was like a free, you know, access to the internet. So you'll hear me say something along the lines of, this is already a terrible idea. Now, you might think it's because of the fact that he's logging in with the username root and there's no password or what. It has nothing to do with that. It's because he's calling a 1-800 phone number. Now, if we back up a little bit, the reason that I'm saying that is because when you call into a 1-800 phone number, they use ANI as part of the billing process. So you remember at the beginning of the show, we talked about ANI, automatic number identification. And let's just back up a little bit and just like assume that Lucky 225 uses his home phone and he calls this 800 number. And he dials in and he gets a PPP connection and he gets on the internet. The problem would be that whenever he called him from his home phone, the billing backend would record his home phone number as part of that process. So 2 months later, they may say, hey, who was calling into this? System? And they would look it up and they would see Lucky 225's phone number. But the reality is, of course, Lucky 225's already two steps, you know, ahead of me. And what he was describing is he would call into the 800 phone number and he would cause a thing called an anti-fail. So that if they ever looked at that billing information, they couldn't trace it back to him. Now, this is where it's going to get a little bit fuzzy for me, to be honest. It's been a long time. He describes dialing 1010-2880. If I remember correctly, and I'm sure I'll get comments if I'm not, this was known as opdiverting. So imagine, and the way this works is imagine that your phone number, you live in Tallahassee, Florida, like I did as a kid, and your local phone company is Sprint. And, you know, that's your local phone company. So if you want to dial long distance, you had to dial Sprint. And if you local calls were all done through Sprint, it was a monopoly. So they came out with a system called carrier identification codes. And the idea was that you could switch carriers. So imagine you're sitting in Tallahassee and you're on a Sprint phone number and you're like, ah, man, I want to call, you know, somewhere else, but it's so expensive to call through Sprint. You could dial this special code and you could use AT&T as your long distance back end. So AT&T being the 1010-288 phone number. But what these guys have figured out is they could use 1010-288 to cause any fail. So even though the phone number calling the phone number is already free, that wasn't the point. The idea was to use 1010-288 and then call the phone number, the target phone number, to cause an anti-fail so that if they ever look back in their billing records, they would have no idea it was Lucky 225 calling. So when you heard me say, this is such a terrible idea, he had already thought about this. Like they're forcing an anti-fail.
So in the 80s, did you actually do a lot of water dialing, like when you were younger?
Little side note here. This is my buddy, Jay Falcon, who I believe has dialed more phone numbers in more countries than any other human I have ever met.
So, yeah, if my machine wasn't dialing out, it was running a BBS or something, or I was playing games. It was always running.
So like, you were war dialing a lot. So this is like what are we talking about? Like 80s here? 1980s?
Yeah. So, we have war dialing and then we're also looking for codes, LD codes.
Oh, true. Oh, so okay. So you're trying to brute force for LD codes and stuff like that back in the day?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of, you know, breaking out of your ladder.
Well, LD code or long distance code busting, is it necessarily war dialing related? I thought it was something worth mentioning. So just to give you kind of a brief synopsis of how it worked, imagine that you are a employee of a company and you are on the road. You're traveling all over the United States. As you travel around, you find yourself in hotels and using payphones. And because remember, the cell phone hasn't been invented yet. But you need to call back to corporate and you need to talk to your wife and family. And you need a convenient way for it to all be billed back, preferably to the company. Maybe to yourself, but we'll say back to the company. So what phone companies had come out with were these long distance provisioning systems. So for instance, you would call a 1-800 phone number. And then you would enter a code, and the code could be anywhere between 4 and 6 digits long in the early days. And after you entered the code, you would get another tone, and then you would enter the phone number that you wanted to dial, be it a business colleague, your wife, your family, whatnot. And then it would ring through, and you would talk to them. And the people footing the bill would be whoever owned that code that you dialed during the initial call setup. So what he's describing doing is using his modem to call that same 800 number, but then try a random code. And the way that he could validate if the code worked or not is when he called the 800 number, it would enter a random code, and then he would have his computer enter a phone number of a bulletin board system, something that he knew a carrier would be on the other side. So if the code worked, he would get a carrier and his computer would connect. And once it connected, it would record the code and say, ah, that's a good code. We can use this later. If it didn't connect, he knew it was a bad code or a code that just didn't work. And then his computer could just redial over and over again. So that's basically what he's describing to circumvent long distance billing.
like the local telephone utilities 411 system, their directory assistance. And it was on a VAX. It actually only lasted for, I think, maybe a month or whatever. And then it never came back up again, or it never answered again. Hmm. But what was interesting about it was there was two sides. It was a VAX system. They even had to log what the login is right on a banner. Go into it, and it presents you a menu. Residential, whatever, and residential business, government. And when you start looking at people's their director assistance information, it would actually show you if it was it was supposed to be listed or unlisted or not, right on the screen.
Yeah. So did you actually do any war dialing like in the 90s, like traditional style, like you're a kid, teenager, doing anything like that?
Oh, hell yeah.
H.D. Moore, hacker, founder of the Metasploit Project, author of Warvox, was the chief research officer at Rapid7. All around great security researcher and all around great guy.
So I got lucky in that my mom had a job as a medical transcriptionist. So she had two phone lines, like normal phone lines for calling the doctors, one to listen to the transcriptions, which is all DTMF based for, forward to the next recording and so on. And one to actually call the doctors and clarify what words they said. And then she also had an ISDN line, which is great because she went to bed early and I didn't.
So you would fire up something like ToneLoc or something like that back in the day?
ToneLoc, a lot of hand dialing as well. And one of the great things about it was having the ISDN line meant that I can actually like ToneLoc on ISDN, which is great.
Most households around this time only had one phone line, which meant, everybody in the family had to share that one phone line. But if you were a hacker kid in the 80s or 90s, you wanted to be on your computer using your modem as much as possible. That could be war dialing, that could be BBSing. So you'll notice a lot of hackers, Jay Falcon kind of alluded to it earlier, we would typically have our own phone lines installed. So mom and the rest of the family could have their little phone line to have their conversations with, but we did the more important work, like war dialing the world using our own phone line, or maybe starting a hacker underground bulletin board on our own phone line, things like that. Anyways, back to H.D. Moore. Probably something that you got you kind of involved with security, would you say? I mean, like early on, was it that kind of stuff?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the same kind of thread has gone through most of my career in security. It's like the fact that there's this huge network out there and it's really hard to discover it. And all you really want to do is like, you want to throw a rock and listen to see where it hits. You want to be able to figure out what's out there and just explore that huge vastness that is this interconnected world that at the time was telephones and these days is the internet and V6 and all the craziness that we have today. And that stuff today is still the reason why I do security.
I grew up, and you probably did as well, as the security industry really wasn't a career path. I mean, computers were around, but nobody had taken computer security very seriously at all. And one of the amazing things to me about things like war dialing is whenever you would dial into some places, the security was so poor in many cases that if you, for instance, like with certain systems that we would dial into, if you just typed in root, it would just let you in. Because I think the thought back then was, well, they don't know the phone number, so how the heck will they ever find the system, kind of thing.
Absolutely. There's still a lot of that today, especially on private networks and different segments of the internet that probably have seen less light. Satellite networks, for example, were still pretty bad until a few years ago, at least. It's fun. I think the lack of visibility is really has hidden a lot of security vulnerabilities across multiple types of networks over the years. When I was dialing locally, there wasn't a whole lot out there. You find a lot of university systems, a lot of HVACs. I think kind of the peak of my criminal career as a stupid 15-year-old was dialing into Kmart and turning their AC on and off. Kind of disappointed. Like, I grew up reading all the old text files, the zines, everything else, reading about PrimeOS systems. I'd printed out manuals for half of AT&T's like Unix hardware, and I never found any of that stuff in the real world. So all I ended up finding were oddball HVAC systems, occasional Unix box here and there, a lot of Solaris out there, especially telco stuff. Some of the fun things here in town were things like the temperature control systems, of course, were great, but also things like the radio towers. So we've got a lot of local radio stations, and they control all their transmissions through towers that are still, as far as I know, controlled through DTMF passwords through dial-in.
By the late 1990s and early 2000s, war dialing was pretty much dead. Not very many people were still doing it. But there was a shift in technology. Of course, the internet was getting ever more and more popular, and people were getting more and more high-speed connections to the internet. And the advent of voice over IP came around. which allowed people to use their internet connections to make phone calls around the world for very, very cheap. From an old school war dialer's perspective, this was incredible because this meant that you are no longer restricted to your local calling area. You could call anywhere in the world and it didn't cost you that much. So what happened is old school war dialers started pulling their modems out of the closets and hooking them up to voice over IP adapters and subscribing to various voice over IP services. By doing this, this meant they could war dial France or Israel or China or anywhere in the world. All they had to do was just pay for the service for the voice over IP and fire up their favorite software, which was usually something like ToneLoc or something like that. Now, briefly, I'd like to go over how cheap this actually is. So remember, when you're war dialing, you're connecting up just long enough to either detect a carrier, or if it's something else like a voice or a busy signal or something like that, you're instantly hanging up. So these are the duration of every phone call is very, very short. The majority of voice over IP providers would bill in 6-second increments. But this is where things like call supervision come into play. So you really only get billed when something on the other end, on your target side, answers the phone. What I mean is, if somebody, a person, answers the phone, or a machine, a modem, or fax machine, then that's when the billing actually gets started. But let's just suppose that your target produces a busy signal. Well, in this case, you will not be charged for the phone call. If the phone number rings out, that is, it rings and rings and rings and nothing ever picks up, you don't get charged for that either. If it produces a sit tone or a special information tone, you don't get charged for that. So the only time that you're really being charged is when something picks up, and then you're doing the analysis as quickly as possible and then hanging up. This means for very, very little money, you can make a lot of phone calls. And it also makes it very difficult for your target to figure out who is calling them, who originated the phone call. Remember, on the PSTN, there were tools like ANI or Annie to help identify who was calling who. Well, over voice over IP, and especially using voice over IP in other countries, because remember, you're not restricted to voice over IP providers in your own country, it makes it really even that much more difficult for your target to understand or figure out who is calling them. This show has been primarily about war dialing. However, I'll bet that you have a cell phone in your pocket. And I'll also bet that that cell phone receives tons and tons of spam phone calls. Well, guess what? The techniques that I'm talking about using for war dialing the world using voice over IP is exactly how these scam call centers are making calls around the world. And not only that, they'll throw in a little caller ID spoofing, which is incredibly easy to do to entice you to pick up the phone. So anyways, to get back to war dialing, people were pulling out their modems and hooking them up to their computers, but they're having to run fairly old software, things like ToneLoc. And as great as ToneLoc was, it didn't change the fact that it ran under things like MS-DOS. And the world had long moved on from MS-DOS. So you're kind of having to jump through some hoops just to get this old legacy war dialing software to even work. That's when some people decided to start writing modern war dialers. When I say modern war dialers, we're still talking in the mid-2000s here. And I was definitely one of those people who wanted to write a modern war dialer. Believe it or not, on the Linux systems, there were no good war dialers. Or I should say Unix systems in general. They were usually these really poorly written, sometimes C programs. They might have been written in Perl. A lot of times they're in shell script that were meant to be war dialers, but they lacked some of the really basic features of like modem control. And they just didn't work very well. Another motivating factor was that I was actively doing pen tests at the time. And part of our pen testing process was not only to scan network equipment and stuff like that, but was also to war dial the a company's prefix, the company that had hired us, to war dial their prefix to look for things like modems, fax machines, PBX equipment, stuff like that. So if I could write a reliable war dialer for Linux or any kind of Nix platform, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, or whatever, then that means I could skip the whole process of loading Tonloc and DOSBox, and I'd have this really great solid war dialer that would do exactly what I wanted it to do. So I decided to write it. And I called that piece of software iWAR. And in the show notes, there is a link to the GitHub page for iWAR. So iWAR worked all well and good as long as you had a VoIP adapter and a modem. And of course, a VoIP provider. It started to dawn on me, what if we could get rid of the modem altogether and the VoIP adapter? That is, have the computer make the phone call. It's certainly powerful enough to make the voice over IP connection. And then also have the computer do the audio analysis to determine if whatever answers on the remote side is a modem, or maybe it could be a human or a tone or a PBX. And then you could start classifying it that way. Well, it ends up I wasn't the only one having these thoughts. Around this time, I ran into this great guy named H.D. Moore, and we traded a little bit of information online, mostly on Twitter. And he was working on a piece of software called WarVox, which was really a tool for analyzing audio over telephone lines. And he was working on his project around the same time that I was working on iWAR. And the cool thing was is that he led me onto things like, for instance, there's a library called KISSFFT. FFT stands for Fast Fourier Transforms, and it allows you to do audio analysis using this particular library. So I kind of grabbed that idea from HD and then started to incorporate it into iWAR.
You were working on a program called WarVox years ago, and I was working on a thing called iWAR, which is a war dialer. I was all console, and you had this like really nice front end to it.
Still way better.
No way. I don't think so. But I appreciate that. But that is simply not the case. Actually, I know people who are still using WarVox. I think you were talking to some Italian friends of mine who were still using WarVox for some of their auditing and whatnot. But so it's like, when did you write that?
I think the first version was like 09, 010. And then, probably earlier. It was 2008, I guess. And then the version 2 came out around 2011.
So you're sitting around, and what were you doing? Like had like some pen test going on? You're like, damn it, I don't want to load DOSBox and Tonloc again. I want to, or you just thought this would be a fun project. How did you get started on that?
The backstory, I think, I was reading Zalewski's book, Silence on the Wire, which one of my favorite security books of all time still, just because it starts off like, you know, I'm going to push a key on my keyboard, and then every single step and every electron that goes from that point on to getting on the internet is documented and described in a way that is just fascinating. So I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about all the other signals in the world, like just like, you know, scanning the internet or word dialing. I like getting, you know, basically scraping signals and finding ways to turn those signals into data. And the more I thought about it, the more all these various audio sources around us all the time are great data that we're just dropping the floor. We're ignoring it. Everything from that annoying person in the airport, whose cell phone starts ringing, to the little notification tone of somebody sitting next to you in the theater. All those are telling you incredible amounts of information about whoever's holding that phone and what they're doing. And all it takes is a little bit of processing to get there. So it started off being kind of an everything audio analysis fingerprinting framework. And then it started turning into, well, where's the best way to get lots and lots of audio? Oh, telephone lines. And how much data could you get out of them? Well, tons. I mean, every corporation out there has a list of all their employees, all their names, all their job descriptions, right, in their voicemail box as a part of the greeting. And if you can harvest that information, you get a lot of information very, you know, very casually, very free, well, at least with not very much effort, compared to much more kind of onerous processes these days using, you know, standard IT networking computers.
So it really started out as kind of like more of a audio framework for just like signal processing, audio signal processing then, huh?
That's where it came out of. And then I realized all the data was really on the phone lines. And it'd be really fun to kind of take the old Tonloc style stuff and apply it to audio. And the main difference between like something like WarVox and kind of standard war dialers is that most war dialers are focused on carriers. And the problem is there's not very many carriers anymore. Like modems are really the super minority of what's out there. But everything else is out there is actually really damn interesting. If you can figure out what these things are, if you can fingerprint them based on the frequencies, you can identify the exact voicemail system based on the tones and the frequencies of it. You can identify mailboxes that haven't been configured yet that you can dial in and then take over. All that stuff is just kind of like out there waiting for you to find it. And it's a discoverability problem. It's really hard to find this stuff. But now that we've got things like cheap voice over IP, it's actually possible to do it. Whereas before it was pretty much, you know, implausible that someone would go through and dial every single voice box within a company in a couple hours. The fun ones for me, when you found, so a lot of the testing was doing fingerprint testing and making sure our existing fingerprints, like, so we had a fingerprint for like Cisco Unified Access voicemail stuff. So we could detect the welcome signature, like, you know, hello, you've reached so-and-so's mailbox. the automated tones, we could fingerprint those and match all those vendors up and bucket them quickly. So we can say, great. So one of the plans of Warbox was to build out pre-calculated fingerprints for all these major commercial products out there so you can figure out what they were. So a lot of what I was doing is anytime I found a big bucket of stuff that I didn't recognize already and it got auto-grouped, I'd go listen to it all and figure out what it was and go through it. And the cool thing is when he found like, you know, 10,000 number range in some random city and three numbers stood out as being wildly different. And the other 9,000 are all like telco error messages, like, you know, beep, boop, beep, things yeah. like that. So you start finding those odd numbers and you find like, you'd still find loops you can dial into. We can dial in one number, then dial another number and talk back and forth. So all that old school kind of freaking stuff came back out again and it was easy to find doing this. Some of the fun ones you found were out dials where you dial into it and drops you straight to a tone. And so I started working on that for quite a bit. And we found a ton in the US. We probably found at least one or two in every city I ever dialed in the first couple of hours, just a random dial tone that you just get dropped to you by accident. Sometimes if you wait for a voicemail message, so Warbox had a configurable timeout. If you waited long enough for, if you set the recording length long enough, the voicemail system would drop you out, but sometimes it wouldn't drop you out entirely. Sometimes it'd drop you back to a dial tone. So we found a lot of voicemail systems where if you just hang out on the line long enough, you get a free dial tone out if you can dial back out.
Nice. So so you could all just like use that as a relay point or whatever you want to do with it.
Yeah, some of the fun ones we found that took a while to figure out were dial tones for international numbers because the international dial tones for like the UK is very different from the US. Same thing with ring through lines. So we'd hit a number and you'd ring with a standard kind of US ring noise, like bring, 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 bring. And then it'd start doing a different ring. It'd be like, brr, 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 and that ends up being the UK's ringtone. So you can actually find numbers that are auto forwarding to international numbers and detect them based on the second ringtone. Yeah. One last story on the Warbox side, something that's kind of fun is, so we got to the point that our similarity detection was pretty good. So you can take any audio sample and say, find me everything else that sounds kind of like that and sort it based on the highest match to the lowest match and then start walking through the samples to figure out what it was. So it was like a voicemail greeting, you'd search for just that snippet of audio, you'd find everything else from that same service provider or telco with the same greeting. So we use that for, if you dialed cell phones from, we had a mode where you can dial Warbox where every call it made, it would spoof the number as the source, as the destination. So if you do that for cell phone lines, even today, it'll actually bypass the ringer, go straight to the voicemail box. If it's not a PIN number set, you go straight into their voicemail. So you can actually mass dial cell phone number ranges, all coming from their own number, and then harvest all their voicemails, and then fingerprint that those voicemails were obtained based on the welcome message from that particular telco provider. So that was one case of very useful. So we would actually use that for red team engagements where a company wanted to figure out if their executives actually had PIN set for their voicemails on their phones, and you know, surprise, they didn't. That was a quick way to quickly test those.
Voiceover IP spoofing could lead to very interesting things. I'm not going to go terribly deep into it on this episode, but you may be able to bypass things like, for instance, voicemail pins. And when you call the target, their phone wouldn't ring. There was also another interesting technique that some war dialers would do called back spoofing. And the idea here is that you would spoof the outbound caller ID and then call another phone number that you owned. Let me explain a little bit further. So it worked like this. Imagine there was a phone number, and we'll say the phone number is 904-555-1212. You would make a outbound call, and you would spoof 904-555-1212, and you would call another phone number that you owned, the idea being that you would use the caller ID system against itself. So if you wanted to find out who owned 904-555-1212, you would call outbound, spoof the caller ID, then call yourself, and then when the phone system or your telco provider or your VoIP carrier or whoever that you're using would look up the target phone number and tell you who owned it. So the idea here would be that you would spoof 904-555-1212, call yourself, the phone system would look up who owns it, it would say it's XYZ Law Firm, now you know XYZ Law Firm owns this phone number. So here's kind of the fun part. So if you were back spoofing and calling yourself on a traditional, say, landline, the phone company would do the what they call CNAME lookup and tell you who owns the phone number. And this was traditionally the best way to do it because you got the most accurate information. However, some VoIP providers also offered this service. The downside of it was that the VoIP provider had to pay what they called a DIP fee to look into the traditional telco's database to find out what the CNAME should be. So on the back spoof, it might cost a few cents for your VoIP provider to look up what the CNAME, the caller ID information should be. So imagine there's an area and you want to collect all the CNAME information for a particular area.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You carve yourself from the spoof and do the dip on it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You do the dip on it. I have a friend of mine who was named Gene Falcon, and he did that all through Malibu because he figured interesting people live in Malibu. And so he did it. Well, the interesting thing about that is, though, he was, of course, going through a VoIP provider and he handed them his $20 for his service or whatnot. But the call never supervises. So there's no charge. You see what I mean? Because you're not going to answer. Like, so, but there's still a dip fee for the CNAME data.
It's like a dip these days.
Yeah, it's not that much. But if you're doing, I don't know, back spoofing 10,000 numbers, he found out basically the carriers got really, really mad. So he would argue with them. They would be like, we've kicked you off our service. And he'd say, oh, well, I still have $20. And maybe we'll give you back your $20. And he's like, well, what are you kicking me off for? I didn't do it. And they're like, we see what you're doing here. And he's like, yeah, but there's nothing in your terms of service saying I can't do this. They'd just be like, just go away. We don't ever want to see you again.
That's great.
I later included caller ID and CNAME information lookups into IWAR. This was actually done by a API call over the internet. So it wasn't done through traditional telco kind of means. Anyways, as you can imagine, if you're war dialing a particular area and knowing who owned the phone number that you had found a carrier on or a fax machine or whatever piece of equipment that you're interested in was super, super important. So before you run out there and start war dialing, also understand too, it doesn't always go as planned. People's phone lines get cut off. Bad things can happen sometimes.
A user who's using IWAR, and we tried to put in protection so that if they, you know, wouldn't dial like 911 and crap like that. But he had somehow made it so he was war dialing something, and I think he was actually using a phone line. He must have been. Anyway, so he was using IWAR, and it ended up calling the police department. And as he was leaving his house, police cars went rushing past him. And he was like, well, that's kind of weird. They seem to be headed back towards my house. So he turned around and went back, and the cops were all in front of his house. And so he approached them and said, what's going on? They're like, well, we keep getting repeated calls for 911 assistance here. No, there's nobody there. And he told them, I shit you not, oh, that's my cat. She sometimes likes to play with the phone. And and they ended up letting him go. And that was a buddy of mine, Savant.
And believe it or not, war dialing could even lead to death.
The really scary ones I heard about were folks who were using it in, you know, overseas kind of battlefields, for lack of terms. Someone reached out and said, hey, you know, a lot of these folks in this area were blowing up their IEDs by calling into, you know, they basically have a cell phone wired up to this bomb. And if you want to blow up the bomb, you dial the number. So this military group decided, well, we're just going to dial every number in this village before driving through. And they blew up the guy in the house.
No way. Really?
Yep.
Holy cow. That is the crazy. The scariest
story by far I've heard is someone in Afghanistan got blown up using Word of Warfox. So someone who used Warbox happened to be deployed, and they're like, let's just try it and see what happens. And at the same time they did the dial, someone's house blew up, and, you know, there's no guarantee that that's what triggered it, but they're pretty sure that it was tied to the phone that they're putting together at the bomb they're putting together at the time was tied to the phone already.
While war dialing was still a lot of fun and you had things like VoIP that would help you make calls around the world, it was getting also increasingly more and more difficult to legally do this, especially within the United States.
Basically, the regulations in the U.S. became really bad for war dialing. EFAX regulation, there's basically a statute that got created as a result of EFAX sending junk faxes to everybody back in the early 2000s. And that has a lot of restrictions for how you can war dial in the U.S. And it became another restriction that went into place, I think in 2008 or 2009, I forget, that limited what you could dial legally even more so. So, for example, you can't dial emergency service providers, even if you don't know their number and they happen to have a second line, technically it'd be illegal to dial them. Same thing goes for senior care facilities after certain times, like all common sense stuff. But if you're dialing a huge range of numbers, it's really hard to legally know what you're dialing or you're not dialing. So for a lot of the future research of Warbox, a lot of that got pushed into international dialing where the laws were less restrictive, which include Russia and Moscow. So we started testing out bandwidth limits and so on. In the US, we were dialing, I think, 10,000 numbers in maybe an hour or two. The problem was you'd overload switches sometimes. So if you're not distributing the total number of numbers widely enough, you'd actually overload an entire small city or town's switch by doing it, you know, by dialing too often. And that actually happened in Moscow. We're dialing... I think it was only a 10,000 number prefix. And in doing so, about 20 minutes into it, I realized all the numbers were immediately going straight to a busy tone. I'm like, what the heck? So I started like hand dialing into it to figure out what was going on. and they all went offline and they stayed offline for 6 hours.
Whoa.
Accidentally broke some switch in Moscow and don't know what happened. And I was like, all right, let's not do that anymore.
I just toned it back a bit.
HD Moore, thank you very much for being on the show.
I love the stuff. It's great to talk to somebody who's excited about like phones and signal analysis and all this stuff as I am. So thanks for running the show. I really appreciate your time.
Well, with any luck, you've learned a little bit more about more dialing. I'd like to thank my friends Lucky 225, Jay Falcon, and HD Moore for being on the show. And if you've been wondering what HD has been getting up to lately, well, here you go.
Let's see. These days, I work with the Atreides Partners as VP of R&D. We do consulting, red teaming, all that fun stuff. And then my other company is Critical Research, where we build Rumble, which is a network discovery product really designed to let folks in IT figure out where their stuff is.
Thanks for listening. If you go to demodulate.io and look up episode 2, you'll find show notes, links to the iWAR GitHub, WarVox links, along with links to Reddit for further discussions on war dialing and this episode. You can also follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is dabeave666. That's DABEAVE 666.
Find a Prime OS box. I don't know how long it takes. It'll be another 30 years, but someday I'm going to find Prime OS box.
Thank you.